Welcome to the AJNR Fellows Journal Club podcast. My name is Christy Lincoln, Assistant Professor of Neuroradiology at the Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. Our three fellows will present their articles in each area of neuroradiology, that is, brain, head and neck, and spine. Each of the discussions will be followed by commentary from myself and two more of our distinguished faculty, Dr. Stephen Chen, our neurointerventionalist, and Dr. Tomas Uribe, our diagnostic neuroradiologist. Now let us begin.
Hello everyone, my name is Nguyen Vu Nguyen. I'm one of the new radiology fellows at Baylor College of Medicine. Today I'm going to discuss an article that was published in the American Journal of Neuroradiology on September 8, 2016. The title of the article is Pre-Radiation Therapy MR Imaging, a prospective pilot study of the usefulness of performing an MR examination shortly before radiation therapy in patients with glioblastoma. This article was written by a multidisciplinary group from Barcelona, Spain. The lead author last name is Mahos. Additional authors are Cos, Castaneda, Pons, Gil, Fernandez, Coelho, Marcia, Bruna, and Aguilera. The goals of this paper is to study the impact of obtaining a pre-radiation brain MRI within 1 week of initiation of radiation in the management and prognostic outcome of patients with resectable glioblastoma. The premises for the study is the fact that the current imaging guideline during the treatment of resectable glioblastoma consists of three brain MRIs. The first brain MRI is obtained shortly after the surgery, hereforth denoted as the early post-op MR or EPMR. The second brain MRI is not obtained until 2 to 6 weeks after the completion of radiation therapy and chemotherapy. The third brain MRI is typically obtained 2 to 4 months afterward as a follow-up. Within this current guideline, assessment for treatment response is done at the time of the second brain MR, using EPMR as the baseline or reference. A common dilemma that is often encountered by radiologists and clinicians using this method is whether to identify progressive finding in this second MR as true progression or pseudoprogression. Pseudoprogression is defined as worsened or progressive imaging finding that is not due to tumor growth. In the setting of resected glioblastoma or chemoradiation treatments, pseudoprogression imaging finding could be related to radiation-induced vasodilation, blood-brain barrier breakdown or inflammatory change, and/or treatment-induced tumor necrosis. A potential explanation as why this dilemma exists is the fact that the time between EPMR and radiation initiation could vary widely. In the current study, it is listed from 27 to 64 days as the range. This may allow residual tumor to regenerate undetected prior to receiving chemoradiation. To address this common problem, the authors propose that the imaging regimen includes one additional brain MR to be done shortly before starting radiation therapy. This proposed pre-radiation MR, hereforth denoted as PRMR, should serve as the baseline rather than the EPMR to assess for treatment response at the time of the second brain MRI, done 2 to 6 weeks after radiation treatment. With this background, the authors hypothesize that the tumor growth before radiation therapy could play a role, in some cases, classify as pseudoprogression. Hence, the incidence of pseudoprogression should decrease. They also postulate that the pattern of tumor growth at time of the proposed pre-radiation MR could be a factor in determining the patient's overall survival. To test their hypotheses, the authors devised a prospective study of 28 subjects with glioblastoma over an estimated 2-year time frame. The inclusion criteria are resectable tumor and that the subjects follow through with all the imaging requirements. The demographics of the subjects can be found in Table 1 of the paper. 3 radiologists were employed to assess and judge the MR studies. The measure outcomes for the first experiment, which study EPMR versus PRMR as the baseline, are the number of true progression, pseudoprogression, stable disease, and partial response. They measure outcome for the second experiment, which studies various pattern of tumor growth on PRMR, is the overall survival rate. In the first experiment, the results show that using PRMR as the baseline more accurately predicts pseudoprogression. Four cases that were listed as pseudoprogression using EPMR as a baseline were recategorized as stable disease in three cases and partial response in one case using PRMR as the reference. A representative case in which the response assessment is progressive disease or pseudoprogression in reference to EPMR examination and stable disease in reference to PRMR examination is shown in Figure 2. There was no difference between using EPMR and PRMR as the reference in identifying true progression. In the second experiment, the authors categorized patterns of tumor growth seen at PRMR using four types: no growth, local growth, global growth, and distant growth. Using this approach, they found that those with global growth had the worst overall survival rate, followed by focal growth. No growth had the best overall survival rate. Distal growth was not included in the analysis due to insufficient sample size. Based on these findings, the authors conclude that PRMR shows relevance in the assessment for treatment response of resectable glioblastoma. Using PRMR as reference helps improve positive predictive value in true progression and may reduce the number of pseudoprogression. Using PRMR as reference shows relevance in pre-radiation planning. The radiologists were able to identify three cases of distal growth using PRMR, leading to alteration of radiation treatment field. And lastly, PRMR may provide independent prognostic information for patients with glioblastoma.
Thank you, Wen, for that summary on pre-radiotherapy MR imaging, a prospective pilot study of the usefulness of performing an MR examination shortly before radiation therapy in patients with glioblastoma. We know that the standard imaging assessment of a patient with glioblastoma is shortly after surgery, another 2 to 6 weeks after chemoradiotherapy is completed, followed by 2 to 4 month follow-up interval examinations. The problem with the 2 to 6 week after chemoradiotherapy scan is pseudoprogression phenomenon. And this study looks to explore to perform an MR scan immediately before radiation therapy in order to improve imaging evaluation of glioblastoma, as MR plays a key role in management. It is my opinion that this is a great study, as the premise is positive impact on management by improving radiation therapy and by decreasing the amount of pseudoprogression cases. This group from Barcelona was able to use conventional sequences, that is, T1 pre and post contrast and FLAIR and DWI, for the pre-radiation therapy analysis, which can be easily used in the community setting as many places are not capable of doing advanced brain tumor imaging. And this wide availability and ease of use makes this study valuable for application. There are, however, many ongoing imaging-based research, including delayed contrast enhancement, that could help in diagnosis. If you have time, this month's AJNR News Digest is focused on glioblastoma. Now we'll move on to Pavitt Baines, who will be presenting his article under the head and neck section.
I will be discussing a clinical report published in the AJNR titled Imaging Appearance of SMARCB1 Deficient Sinonasal Carcinoma, a Newly Described Sinonasal Malignancy. This paper was authored by Schatzkes, Ginsberg, Wong, Aiken, Brandstetter, Michael, Hagen on July 7, 2016. The most common sinonasal malignancy is squamous cell carcinoma, representing approximately 60% of cases. Additional tumors to consider include sinonasal undifferentiated carcinoma, esthesial neuroblastoma, sinonasal lymphoma, and sinonasal adenocarcinoma. SMARCB1 is a tumor suppressor gene located on chromosome 22 that has been involved in rhabdoid malignancies of the kidneys, soft tissues, and central nervous system. The first reports of SMARCB1 deficient tumors of the sinonasal cavity began to appear in the literature in 2014. This study was performed as a retrospective case series with 17 total cases collected from 6 tertiary centers, including 10 men and 7 women with an average age of 54 years. Many of these tumors were initially diagnosed as a sinonasal undifferentiated carcinoma or poorly differentiated carcinoma, and the majority were staged as T4 cancers at the time of resection, 14 out of 17 cases. All available pretreatment imaging, including CT, MR, and/or PET CT, were reviewed by a single radiologist with over 20 years of experience. MR imaging was available for 14 out of 17 patients, PET CT was available for 11 patients, and CT images in 13 patients. The tumor characteristics recorded include a specific location within the sinonasal cavity, presence of any intracranial, orbital, or perineural extension, and the presence of regional, nodal, or distant metastases. The specific CT and MR imaging characteristics were also described. All patients underwent surgery and variable chemoradiation regimens. The results demonstrate that the SMARCB1 deficient sinonasal carcinoma was most commonly isolated within the nasoethmoidal region, representing 8 out of 17 cases, and followed by the nasal cavity, which included 5 out of the 17 cases. Epidural intracranial extension was seen in 8 out of 17 tumors, and orbital involvement was present in 9 out of 17 patients. Of the 13 patients who had preoperative CT imaging, internal calcification was identified in 6 out of 13, three of which demonstrated a peculiar spiculated hair-on-end pattern of calcification along the interface with adjacent bone, suggestive of an aggressive periosteal reaction. Erosive bony changes were identified in 9 out of 17, and expansile bony deformation was seen in 5 out of 17. All tumors demonstrated avid contrast enhancement. Restricted diffusion was present in 9 out of 11 cases, and FDG uptake was present in all cases with PET CT. Previous reports suggest that SMARCB1 deficient sinonasal carcinomas represent 3 to 14% of previously diagnosed sinonasal undifferentiated carcinomas. No clear pathognomic features are described, however, in this case series, there is a predilection for central sinonasal structures, including the nasal and nasoethmoidal regions, with frequent invasion of orbital and intracranial compartments. Aggressive periosteal reaction was seen in a small subset of patients, although no tumor calcification was present at histopathologic analysis, and this may represent a common bony reaction. Limitations of this study include a small sample size and limited clinical patient information. The presence of rhabdoid features on cytopathologic examination can help alert clinicians and pathologists towards the possibility of this diagnosis.
This is Stephen Chen commenting on the paper. Pavit, nice job summarizing the paper on the SMARCB1 deficient sinonasal carcinoma. I think we'll be seeing more and more articles like this as we do molecular analysis on tumors that we originally thought were one entity but actually have different genetics. Just earlier this month, I saw that another subtype, SMARCA4 deficient sinonasal carcinoma, was described in the Journal of Head and Neck Pathology. In this area of personalized medicine, I think the hope is that eventually we can customize therapy for each molecular subtype and discover unique characteristics for each subtype. And these papers play certainly a role in this sort of analysis. Of course, as the angiographer, I do wish this paper includes some angiograms so we could see the angiographic characteristics of these tumors. Many of these tumors, as you know, are being embolized preoperatively to minimize blood loss. Well, Pavit, nice job again, and thanks for summarizing the paper.
Hi, my name is Juan Pablo Juan Ramirez, and my article is Dorsal Lumbar disc migration with lateral and ventral epidural extension on axial MRI. This is a case series in review of the literature. This is by Dr. Nasser, Sarabian, Din, Kotsinas, Walt, and Yu. This article was published in the American Journal of Neuroradiology in July 7 of 2016. First, to talk briefly about this type of disc herniations. Per the second version of the lumbar disc nomenclature, a disc extrusion is defined as a disc herniation that is displaced beyond the outer annulus of the disc material with any distance between the edge greater than the distance between the edges of the base. The term migration refers to displacement of disc material away from the site of extrusion, regardless of continuity with the disc in either the sagittal or axial plane. Lumbar disc extrusions are common, with this material typically migrating superiorly, inferiorly, or laterally. However, migration into the dorsal epidural space is rare. This was first described by Lombardi in 1973 as a posterior rotation of the annulus fibrosus. Posterior migration of the disc is thought to be anatomically inhibited by the posterior longitudinal ligament and the peridural membrane, midline septum, epidural fat, venous plexus, dura, and nerve root. Dorsal lumbar disc migration is very rare, with less than 100 reported cases. Usually their clinical presentation is catecholamine, which is reported in approximately 55% of the cases, and there are no pathognomonic imaging features. The differential diagnosis for this pathology is a synovial cyst, hematoma, abscess, or neoplasm. The purpose of this clinical report was to analyze the soft tissue abnormalities on axial MRI in both the ventral and lateral epidural space in surgically proven cases of dorsal epidural migrations and on the images of previously published cases. This clinical report was a retrospective study performed at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. After obtaining the IRB approval, three CAQ-certified neuroradiologists with more than 6 years of experience were used to interpret the images. First, let's talk about the case series. In this part, six cases were chosen from the Spine Clinic and Mayo Clinic. In each case, the radiologists read the initial study as something other than a migrated disc, but later all cases were surgically and pathologically proven to be a migrated disc. Basically, the radiologist initially read two of the cases as epidural abscess, two of them as epidural hematoma, and one as a synovial cyst. Of the six cases, each one was found to have a lateral soft tissue and ventral soft tissue component abutting the disc, and 100% of the cases with MRI with contrast available show peripheral enhancement. Now, the other part of the report was to analyze previously published articles with a total of 52 patients out of 22 articles. From this, they included 24 of the cases due to availability and quality of images. From these 24 cases, 96% of them show a lateral component and 94% show ventral abutment from the parent disc. At the end of this report, it was concluded that dorsal epidural migration of lumbar disc extrusion is rare and commonly misdiagnosed. Ventral and lateral soft tissue abnormalities are typically present on axial MRI and may help the radiologist suggest this uncommon diagnosis in the appropriate cases, or at least included in the differential diagnosis. It also concludes that by MRI, we're unable to differentiate a dorsal disc migration from a hematoma, abscess, synovial cyst, or neoplasm. Limitations of the study are the small sample, being a retrospective study, and the expectation bias by the neuroradiologist.
This is Thomas E. Ribe commenting on the article, Dorsal Disc Migration with Lateral and Ventral Epidural Extension on Axial MRI, a case series and review of the literature, published on AJNR last year. Juan, good job summarizing the paper. This is a very interesting case review article of dorsal epidural disc migration, a rare and commonly missed entity. In this article, it was misdiagnosed in the majority of cases by experienced neuroradiologists. They consider other differential diagnoses such as abscess, synovial cyst, and hematoma, not contemplating the possibility of disc herniation. A review of the literature published images summarizing the most common MR radiological findings on this pathology was also presented, a good resource to have on hand. The take-home message of this article is that if an asymmetric posterior epidural mass with ventral component and without bone changes is seen in an MR of the spine, always including your differential diagnosis, migrated extruded disc material among other usual suspects. Again, this is not a straightforward diagnosis, but now we know it exists and the most common image presentation. Juan, thanks for a well-done summary on this paper.
Thank you, Wen, Pavit, Steve, Juan, and Tomas, for your time and efforts to provide a comprehensive overview and commentary of these interesting publications. We hope you enjoyed listening to the podcast and will find time to read these great articles.